Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books and Literary Studies. I'm John Yorgo, your host. When I first decided to try my hand at interviewing authors for the New Books Network, one of my dream guests was Steve Mintz. Steve's work in the environmental humanities marries a rigorous archival orientation, path-breaking close readings, and a fluent and innovative approach to scholarly writing. I think he's charted a course for early modern eco-criticism that has been both impressive and energizing. Steve Mintz is a professor of English at St. John's University. He has produced numerous books that have shaped the emerging field of the blue humanities, including Shipwreck Modernity, At the Bottom of Shakespeare's Ocean, the Bloomsbury Objects Entry, Ocean, and the recent Introduction to the Blue Humanities. He has published a chapbook of poetry, Swim Poems. His Bookfish blog is also a wonderful index for scholarly and creative work happening right now. Today, I am excited to discuss his most recent book of blue poetry, Sailing Without Ahab, just published by Fordham University Press in 2024. Welcome to the podcast, Steve.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really, really a pleasure to be here, John.
Can you start by giving a short overview of Sailing Without Ahab? What is the book about?
Sure. Thanks very much. So the book is a book of poetry, and it's the first time I've written and published a book of poetry. And it is a form of creative critical engagement with Melville's Moby Dick and also with my own oceanic environment. I think that the book is, you know, significantly engaged with Moby Dick. It's at sort of multiple levels, and there is one chapter in the book one poem in the book for every chapter of Moby Dick. But it's also deeply engaged with my own sort of daily swimming practice on the Connecticut shoreline where I live, and my own, you know, life as a person who's always been fascinated with the ocean, other forms of water, especially ocean swimming, and thinking about how to bring those things together. So it's both a reading and also a kind of narrative or a kind of watery autobiography, I suppose I would say, entangled with this kind of reading with a novel that's been super important to me since I was pretty young.
In which bodies of water are those that you most commonly swim in?
So I live on the Connecticut shoreline, just, you know, the Long Island Sound is right down the street from me here in Brantford, Connecticut. And so once it warms up a little bit, so sometime in May, probably, I will swim every day until it gets too cold again around November. But I also grew up on the Jersey Shore. And so these two parts of the Atlantic, both of which get, you know, pretty significant mentions and discussions in the book, are the kind of central oceans for me. The daily ocean now is Long Island Sound, which is, you know, without waves and relatively placid and warm water. And then the Jersey Shore, which has a little bit more surf to it. Those are the two that are really central to me, although I've swum in lots of other oceans as well.
The title of your book begs a question. Mm-hmm. Why is Ahab disinvited from our journey?
So the sort of initial and initiating fantasy of this book is that what if we can have a voyage onto the ocean without the oppressive, tyrannical captain who's always telling us what to do? What if we could replicate something of the voyage out onto the wonder world of the world ocean without obsession, without a certain kind of manic violence, without anger at a particular whale and the kind of violence that is driven by Ahab's madness and his obsession? What if instead our guide onto the world ocean voyage of the Pequod could be something that's more speculative, more literally aimless, that's not driven by a particular aim, and also more democratic, more polyphonic, more embracing of other perspectives, human and non-human. So the whole idea of the voyage, as I retell it and reimagine and re-inhabit it, is going without tyranny, without authoritarianism, without this obsessive structure. And so, like, there's a kind of linguistic constraint, right, that I don't use the word Ahab anywhere except the title and the introduction. But, like, in the poems themselves, his name doesn't get mentioned. His absence is always deeply felt. Like, there are many cases in which you can sort of tell the thing that I am talking around. And, you know, obviously any readers of Moby Dick will recognize the absence of this central figure. But the hope is that, or the fantasy, I suppose, the utopian dream of this book is that it might be possible to leave behind the weight of authoritarianism and obsession and control.
It seems to me that, and this is something I think I'm latching onto, is like author and authority. And the way Moby Dick itself is like such a display of mastery and authority and power over all of these different realms of knowledge and literary sources and everything. How can we leave behind that idea of authority and also, I guess, carry forward or memorialize a certain kind of literary power? So political power, perhaps we leave behind deliberately and intentionally, but carry forward a kind of literary power?
I think that's a really insightful and thoughtful question, right? That there's certain kinds of authority that we want to leave behind, a certain kind of violence or domination, and also a certain kind of authority and ability to shape language or to perceive things, especially things in things in the ocean that are other than ourselves. And I think it's really difficult to leave authority behind without entering into sort of complete chaos. I think that one of the things that I do in this book, or that I try to do, is I at least engage with the idea of how much order we can take away without running into a kind of lack of meaning. Although I also think the lure of like utter meaninglessness is actually really present. One of the things I say in the introduction is that there are 138 poems. They follow the chapters of Moby Dick, you know, without numbers, but in order. But I hope that when people read the book, that they don't necessarily read them, you know, sort of 1 to 138, that you read it in any order that you want, that you sort of flip around in the pages, that you imagine that that we are no longer bound to the animating structure of authorship and authority, but we can actually play within that structure instead of being tied to it, as it were.
Yeah, I love that idea. Play, maybe dissolving some of the links to authority and certainty. I would love it if you could read a poem for us. Mm-hmm. Would you read "Storm and Wreck"? And
I think sure. Page 9. Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to. So this one is called "Storm and Wreck," and just some of the titles of the poems are the same as the corresponding chapter in Moby Dick, but this one is not. It's possible that the, you know, hardcore Moby Dick fans in the audience will recognize the chapter because I do quote from Melville, but this one, Storm and Wreck, is my title. Storm and Wreck. "Woe," says the ancient sailor, "to him who seeks to pour oil on the waters when God has brewed them into a gale." I puzzles those words in the storm, when water rages beyond confines, fits itself beyond containers, spills out to soak bodies and flood dry places. What is woe? A sadness that comes from loss, not destruction, but a sudden absence of order, of the way things were, patterns that can be explained. What does oil mean to a mariner, a preacher, a poet? Thick, warm liquid poured onto the curling locks of boy kings, the whale's secret case, the black fire with which we have flamed the planet. How does God brew gales? What turnings and combinations, what measurings and bakings, what pauses and restarts, what unknowable plans does it take to create the disorder from which we yearn to make meaning, raining down on us from him?
Thank you. It's a wonderful poem. I guess I was drawn to this because of the themes of storm, shipwreck, which I know as you've helped us explore and understand in the early modern context, and just connecting with the themes we've already raised about chaos or leaving behind authority. Can you talk to us a little bit about the process of writing this poem?
Yeah, I mean, I love the fact that you chose this one for our conversation on this podcast, because it is very much a kind of moment. It's like a close reading poem, that a poem that fits in the, you know, I suppose the professional description of us literature professors. And I'm really trying to take apart some of the lines in this. Is a passage in Father Mapple's sermon from Moby Dick. And it is, you know, a moment in which he's describing God as the author of shipwreck, the author of human destruction on the sea, and tries to understand the particular kinds of supernatural or theological order that sit behind the storm. And so wrestling with the words woe, oil, and brew, you know, brew as in the causation of the gale, I'm trying to sort of think through the puzzle around causation. That, I mean, again, I've been writing about shipwrecks for a long time too, and like the puzzle around what causes the wreck. Is it God's will? Is it bad sailing? Is it bad weather? Are those things distinguishable? This is always a puzzle in shipwreck, whether you're responding to it as a poet, a playwright, or an insurance adjuster. That shipwreck is a causation entanglement. And this is a poem that tries to dig into and splash around a little bit with that causation entanglement.
How was, can you talk a little bit about the process of putting the poem together? Were those always the three words that you were going to zoom in on? A woe, oil, and brew? Or were there other words?
Well, that phrase from the sermon, woe to him who seeks to pour oil on the waters when God has brewed them into a gale, is a line from this sermon I've been wrestling with for quite a long time. One of my earliest published articles, you know, 20 years ago now, uses that as an epigraph for an article about shipwreck and Sir Philip Sidney. And so I've been sort of like grappling with that sentence for a long time. And, you know, in some ways, the poem does the thing that I try to do when I'm mystified by and wrestling with a complicated sentence, is to sort of break it down to its component parts and to isolate just a couple of words and think about how Melville makes meaning out of them, and also how that meaning might be exportable, right? How that meaning might come and touch, you know, me in the present. As a, you know, especially as an ocean swimmer and someone who lives on a sometimes stormy coastline.
That's wonderful. Robert Frost has this quote, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader, no surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader. How do you stay alive to surprise as a poet?
Mm-hmm. That's a great, I mean, that's obviously such a gorgeous statement from Frost, and I love the question. And I think about, like, In a very clear way, this poem is a kind of collaboration and active rereading of a favorite canonical text. But I also think that the moments of surprise and urgency and the kind of feeling of the poems often come from my collaboration with the ocean down the street from me, right? So especially in the summertime, when I get into the ocean every day, I tend to think a lot about lines of writing and lines of poetry while I'm swimming. Many of these poems were written, rewritten, imagined while I was in the process of swimming around the bay here in Connecticut where I live. And so the kind of pressure and form of being in the water, being a terrestrial mammal in an aqueous space, is very much at the heart of these poems. And I, you know, in some ways I come back to this same question of sort of how do I fit myself into an alien and inhospitable environment? And how do I, you know, make a kind of provisional order through the, you know, movements of my arms and legs and you know, patterned breathing. And that is for me a process that is deeply related to the process of making order out of language.
That's a great phrase, taking a swim with an idea, that you work through an idea through the embodied encounter with water. Can you walk us through sort of phenomenologically what that's like? Like, do you feel like pushing against the flow of the water, it allows you to, I don't know, break through with an idea? Does it sort of chime with a certain kind of rhythm of an idea?
I think rhythm more than, I mean, both of those things are present, right? There is both a kind of struggle and a, you know, struggle with an alien environment, and also a kind of rhythm that is, I mean, ideally when one swims and gets into a rhythm, you end up, you know, going faster but working less hard, right? There's a kind of smoothness that comes from the, from you know, like being in the right form. And I think of that really as deeply analogous to sort of finding the right words for a poem or any, or a sentence or any piece of writing, that you can, it is possible, especially if it's windy or if the weather is bad or if, you know, something is psychologically in turmoil, that, you know, you can feel really unsettled. I mean, literally unsettled in the sense when you go into the water. And then I usually take, you know, an idea or a couple sentences or a half line of poetry with me to think about and work my way through it and just try to repeat it and reshape it and reform it once I get into a rhythm of my arms and my legs and my breathing and the, you know, a rhythm that also is often interrupted by different, by the swell of the water, by birds, by jellyfish, not all that often, but sometimes unpleasantly by jellyfish, and, you know, the other creatures that share my bay in the summer. It also includes, you know, sailboats and windsurfers and paddle boarders. So there's a kind of community, a human and non-human community, that I try to fit myself into when I swim. And I think about that same act of fitting as very much the act of writing as well.
I want to zoom out and talk about the writing of poetry. Mm-hmm. How did you develop your poetic style and techniques? Was writing poetry always a part of your practice, or did you come to it after, you know, a period of literary criticism, doing that primarily?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I was, you know, over the, I've been publishing literary criticism for 20 some odd years, right? Since around the late 90s or around 2000. And I've only been publishing poetry for a very short period of time in the last, you know, 2 to 3 years. And so I've been writing poetry, and I was a creative writing concentration English major as an undergraduate also, although I was mostly writing prose fiction in those days. And so I think that it sort of took me a long time to come back around to a kind of poetic writing that was, that I felt comfortable sharing, you know, that I felt comfortable bringing out into the world, the way that this book is now out in the world. And so in a lot of ways, though, I would also say that the work that I have been doing as a sort of straightforward literary critic, right, you know, a book about Shakespeare, or a book about shipwreck narratives, has always been trying to sort of push on the form a little bit of literary criticism. So there are creative excursus in my books of criticism for years now, and sometimes poems as well. And so, like, this is the, in some sense, I've stepped over from criticism into poetry, but it still is about the relationship between critical thinking and poetic composition. You know, it sort of works on both sides of the creative critical boundary. And I think that it gets a lot of its energy from moving back and forth across those modes.
Yeah, and I'll say your literary criticism has a lot of flair and style, like, which is wonderful. And I can kind of see that continuity. I guess I'm sort of also interested in the way you kind of developed as a poet outside of like the MFA workshop kind of model, even though you did some of that as an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. Did you, I don't know, try to recapture that in other ways? Like, did you have a group of poets that you like workshopped with, or?
So to the extent that I did, it was a group called the Sonic Corona Project, which took shape during the pandemic. Corona, in addition to being a name for a virus, is also a sonnet structure, right? So a corona of sonnets is a linked set of 14 sonnets in which the last line of one sonnet is the first line of the next one. And then you go all the way back around until the 14th one sort of links back to the first. And so a bunch of us in the early days, when things were kind of bleak and confusing and we were all shut in 2020, a bunch of us started writing coronas together. Mm-hmm. And we ultimately did 14 coronas total. So that's, you know, some very large number of sonnets. They were all written in the course of a day. And so, you know, and you obviously didn't get the first line of your sonnet until the last line of the previous one had been written. So it was a truly kind of spontaneously generated process. Mm-hmm. And I loved it. I mean, I found it just to be so incredibly stimulating and exciting, like waiting for the line that would release you into a poem that you wanted to write, and not knowing what it was or when during the day it was come. Some people posted in the morning, some people posted in the evening. Everybody like made it within the 24-hour window, I think, over the course of, you know, the many months that we were working on this project together. And that was definitely a kind of a jump start for my poetry. I'd been thinking before that about the Sailing Without Ahab project, and I'd even published a couple pieces in an online poetry journal, Poetry and Criticism Journal, you know, to sort of think about the project. But that community of the Sonic Corona Project really got me into the mode during that strange year of 2020 and 2021. And in some ways, I think that like the project owes a lot to the pandemic, although I don't think of it exclusively as a pandemic project, right? It had a before life and an afterlife, but it had a kind of crucial transformation in that period.
That's interesting. I was just talking to someone else who started producing comic books after mm-hmm. after the pandemic. And yeah, what you're saying is absolutely right. There was a sort of continuity before mm-hmm. the project, but some, you know, and of course the pandemic came with sort of horrifying consequences, but was also a kind of portal for new creative ventures mm-hmm. in an interesting way.
Yeah, I think that it was a time of such radical change, and like the possibility of like actually doing something that I'd sort of thought that maybe I would want to do. It's like, well, maybe I should do it right now, because like, you know, there is time, and like, who knows what is happening in the world? So you might as well like do the thing you want to do now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I was reading Sailing Without Ahab, I was also struck by the formal and conceptual departure from Moby Dick. This is a short book about a long book, a collection of lyric poems about a genre exploding hyperverbal prose work, discretion and concision as opposed to totality and verbosity. How did you come to conceptualize that relationship between your book and Melville's book?
Yeah, I love this question. I mean, in some ways, I do think of this project as a really intense rereading of Moby Dick, a book that I've been rereading and teaching obsessively since I was a young man. And, you know, a book that changes underneath you whenever you go back to it. So, I've been, you know, teaching it in recent years and, you know, reading it for the first time as a young teenager and like not really knowing what was going on with it, like in some ways feeling the overwhelm of it. But I also think that the, like what I'm trying to do in this book is to turn the act of reading into a kind of creative practice, right? That it is very intensely a deep rereading of this, you know, massively familiar book, at least familiar to those of us who are Americans and Anglophone literature people. But it also is taking the sort of titanic imagination that this book provides and turning it into idiosyncratic directions, like turning it away from. And again, this is the, like, there is a sense in which Ahab represents obsession and violence, but also a kind of totality and fixedness, right? Ahab is the principle of order in a certain way. And what this book hopes to do is to add a little disorder and a little swerve to that that kind of orderly structure.
Would you read Whalefall, which is on page 79?
I would love to. Whalefall. What monuments, what rites, what farewells. Its buoyancy pierced, the skeleton sinks, taking its place in eternal sea snow, that the accumulation of sediments that assembles history and ecology and the undersea. What is I to make of its unceremonied descent? O horrible vulturism of earth, I laments, from which not the mightiest whale is free. Whale falls populate the deep as biomass. They spiral slowly down to crevices and scavenger bottoms. Fish and crabs and bivalves follow alongside deep sea creatures whose outlines we can barely envision. The whale fashions its own monument.
I'm in general just fascinated with whale falls. Like I often assign, you know, short films about whale documentaries to students in my environmental humanities courses. And just I find it such a powerful metaphor of like living in this sort of afterlife of other beings. Can you talk to us about some of the qualities of this poem that strike you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I share that obsession and that fascination and this idea that the body of the whale is so generative and productive after its own demise, right? The way in which the sinking whale fall becomes a massive habitat and an ecology. I was thinking about Rebecca Giggs's book Fathoms, which is a recent book about whales. She's a writer from Australia, and like her depiction of a whale decomposing on the beach in Perth in the 2010s, I think, is just this amazing evocation of the whale as, well, in her case, still living and suffering mass of flesh. And so I'm trying to think in this poem about what happens to all that biological matter and how it serves as the monument to the whale and also might serve as a kind of metaphor for a monument to a work of literature that is also like in some sense dead and in some sense generative.
Yeah, I guess Ishmael's line sort of emphasizes how the mightiness of the whale, like it would be inconceivable for us that it would capitulate to these gradual processes driven by, you know, in some cases, microorganisms.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the relationship between the mighty and the massive and the visible, occasionally visible, and the microscopic and the tiny but inexorable processes of microorganisms.
Yeah, tiny but inexorable. Yeah, that's great. What was the revision process on this poem? Did you do you move linearly? Do you kind of have a structure for a poem in advance?
I think it varies a lot from poem to poem. In this particular one, I mean, I tend to also work through, like, there are lines and phrases either from Melville or from someone else that I sort of take with me when I'm either when I'm swimming a poem or when I am writing one. So the accumulation of sediments is a line from Rachel Carson, and sea snow is a, well, it's a way that biologists describe the passing of biological matter through the water column, but I also associate that with Rachel Carson. And so both of those are thinking about the ocean as Carson has taught us to understand it, as the kind of structuring biological entity that organizes the ecosystem of the planet. And so in some ways, I think I'm trying to nod to her in this piece as well. I mean, and elsewhere too. I mean, she's one of the great sea writers of the 20th century, as Melville is of the 19th century.
I've never, I haven't read her work on oceans. That's great.
Before Silent Spring, she wrote three books about the ocean. And they're really fantastic and quite amazing.
Okay. What is it about her work that you find on the ocean that you find particularly inspiring?
So I think that I mean, she's both a scientist and is trying to make the science as it existed in the mid-century available to a readership, but she also has this gorgeous eye for poetic language and poetic connection. And I think her understanding of the way that the ocean structures the environment of humans, not just humans who like go to the seashore, but humans everywhere on the planet, is amazingly acute. And her sense of the kind of urgency of understanding parts of the ocean that were especially then quite invisible, you know, sort of before a lot of recreational scuba diving or underwater photography, at least her early books, and the way in which she makes the dependence of the terrestrial on the marine really visible and emotionally present as well as physically present is I suppose that's the thing that I mainly take from her.
I was just watching a TV show, The Three Body Problem, and mm-hmm. Carson's work bubbles up in that as sort of evidence of a pessimism about humanity and mm-hmm. about, you know, what we brought on Earth. I should really go back to her work. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think Silent Spring has a kind of pessimism that is not quite as present in the sea around us or under the sea wind, maybe because, you know, that was like the thing she was uncovering was so horrifying, I think, in Silent Spring.
There's this idea in a lot of eco-criticism that by imitating the sounds of the earth, of the environments around us, we might invent fresh ways of looking at the world, at society, and so on. That environments can have a bracing effect on the social forms that we implement and that are imposed on us. Kamau Brathwaite writes, quote, "The hurricane does not roar in pentameter," as a way of thinking about how local environments can invite us to innovate literary form. Are these bodies of waters, rivers, oceans, bays, that have modeled for you new ways of seeing the world? Have these watery bodies ever patterned forms of social organization and social action for you?
Absolutely. I mean, I love this question. And I do think of, this book is a collaboration with two different non-human entities. One is Melville's novel and the other is Long Island Sound, right? The other is the water down the street from my house where I swim in the summers. And the particular shapes of both of those things exert all, like, I'm both fascinated with the ocean and the experience of being in the ocean, and also fascinated with Melville's novel. And I think that, like, my the process of writing this book has been trying to take seriously on as many levels as possible the collaborations that are possible, you know, both with a canonical literary text and also with this moving physical alien environment that is also like deeply intimate, like it is right down the street from me. I mean, one of the features of the book that I really love the most is the gorgeous map that John Wyatt Greenlee made for me, which is half a map of the world and the Pequod's voyage from Nantucket to the Sea of Japan, you know, sort of taking, following the line of it. That's the sort of lower half of the map upside down. And then the upper half of the map is a map of my local bay in Brantford, Connecticut, with the, you know, the rocks and points and islands that I swim through in the summer. And the voyage of the Pequod in this map takes us from the World Ocean in Nantucket into Short Beach, where I live, and then back to the Sea of Japan. And it's a beautiful, I mean, I love the map as a representation of what the book was really trying to imagine, which is simultaneously a voyage onto the sort of world ocean, the global ocean that structures our planetary climate and environment, and also a kind of reconnection between the global and the local. So it's a very strange map in a sense that like people who look at it will, you know, you'll recognize the Americas and Afro-Eurasia, but you might not recognize Whale Rock and Kelsey Island and Green Island, the sort of local landmarks, land and sea marks here. But the project of trying to integrate those two things is really central to the book. And I'm so grateful for John for making that map for me.
Yeah, the map is wonderful. Yeah, it was really striking when I read it. And it, in fact, the whole kind of design of the book, I like the cover quite a bit.
Yeah, the cover is also just gorgeous. It was made originally by a St. John's graduate student many years ago for a pamphlet that I was putting together for a Babel conference, actually, back in the mid 2010s, and. Yeah, I'm so happy that we were able to use it for this as well.
Could you read At Sea?
Yes, At Sea. What is direction out of sight of land? To be boundless, disoriented, when two throes of white lap the Nantucket wood of the angular bow. Sometimes a storm inverts the needle because the directions east and west are arbitrary map-makers' conventions, impositions of direction on the all-exceeding expanse of surge and mirrors. On the masthead, not seeing across wideness, eye ignores the needle. Done with the compass, done with the chart.
I mean, it of course jumped out to me because of the Dickinsonian echo at the end, yep. Which is the poem I often assign.
Yep.
And it, you know, one of the reasons I assign it is because of all of the editorial sort of controversies around,
yeah,
you know, her family wanted to kind of suppress the more explicit parts of the poem. But it's also like such an interesting ecological poem on its own. And you've kind of brought Dickinson into conversation with Melville here.
Yeah, my very idiosyncratic reading of Emily Dickinson is that she's a great maritime poet, that she has a relatively small number, you know, in her massive corpus of poems that think with and about the sea, including this one, and a few others. Exaltation is the Going is maybe the most famous one about embarkation. And I think that for Dickinson, who, unlike Melville, is not a mariner or a whaleman or any of these things, right? But thinks about the sea, you know, also writing from 19th century New England, thinks about the sea as a representation of vastness and motion and the, you know, the thing which is always beyond human capacities. And so Dickinson for me is a really important sea writer, that I think of her and her poems when I'm grappling with Melville, when I'm grappling with the ocean, and when I'm swimming. I mean, I do use the poem Exaltation is the Going as my sort of first swim of the year poem every year, that I go and recite it to myself and then dive into the cold water whenever I can't stand not being in the water again, usually again in May. depending on the weather. But, you know, for me, she's a particularly acute observer of the kind of lure of the sea as, you know, as the going, or she says, or as a kind of alternative to these structures of human terrestrial control, including compasses and charts in this poem.
That's great. Do we, I'm going to be like a kind of crass biographical a reader now. Do we know that she visited the, or like looked on the Atlantic at any point?
I don't know. I mean, Amherst is not that far from the Massachusetts coastline. Yeah. But I don't know any specific details about her encounter with the sea.
Yeah. You know, I lived in that area for a while, so I'm sure we've both encountered some of the same rivers or waterways, including the Connecticut River.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Snakes through there. Interesting. Other things about the poem that strike you?
About the Dickinson?
Oh, about at
which one? Your poem. Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, the other thing I would say about this poem just is that it is an effort to make sense of the experience of disorientation, which I take as fundamental. When a terrestrial mammal goes into an aquatic environment, there's some kind of fundamental disorientation, which comes with, you know, buoyancy and being in an environment that where we can't breathe if we're submerged in it, and there's a kind of basic, you know, taking us out of our element that is, you know, involved in every encounter with a kind of watery environment, you know, even in the bath or whatever, that there is a way in which the process of immersion is always a process of disorientation, even when it is followed by a kind of reorientation through, you know, through technologies like a ship or practices like good form in swimming, that there's a kind of initial disorientation that is then responded to with different kinds of tools and different kinds of forms.
Yeah, and I suppose that sense of control, I mean, reading, because the directions west and east, quoting you, mm-hmm. Are arbitrary map makers' conventions, impositions of direction, that a lot of that control, sense of authority is artificial or is illusory.
Exactly. Yeah. That the prospect that the being accommodating oneself to being in the sea is also learning not to want certain degrees of control. Certain degrees of control you need, right, in order to keep yourself safe and alive. But there are kind of fantasies of ultimate control and order that I think are corroded by contact with the sea.
With the exclusion of Ahab, I imagine that creates space for other voices, other characters, other experiences. So who gets to take up more space with Ahab's absence?
You know, I think that it was not something I planned so much as something that I noticed, which was that the character who sort of surged into view is the character of Queequeg, who in the poems I refer to as through his initial Q. And, you know, there are two characters who I refer to by initials. I is Ishmael, and also, you know, me, the narrator, the author, and Q is Queequeg. And so the you know, surging into this space is Queequeg as the bosom friend, to use Ahab's, to use Melville's, phrase for him in a chapter title, and also he is the lover, the husband, the partner, the idealized version of aquatic humanity, and so Queequeg really is the, like, when you can put Ahab aside or on shore, you get to spend a little more time with Queequeg, and that's one of the things that the book is trying to do. I could read the sort of introduction of Queequeg poem if you want.
Please, it'd be lovely.
This one is called A Bosom Friend. This is one of the poems where I take the title from Melville's chapter title. No place like a bed and no love like Q. No warmth like the sun and no ship like the P. No food like chowder and no book like his tattoos. No task like head selling and no place like New Bedford. No shave but with a harpoon, and no breakfast but beefsteaks. No head but George Washington's, and no hat but Abe's. No kindness but pagan, and no simplicity but his heart. No chill like the darkness, and no blanket but his idol. No warmth but a low fire, and no voyage but for whales. No smoke but from his pipe, and no chat but till morning. No future but with him, and no ship like the pea. No place like a bed, and no love like Q.
That's great. And one of the things that strikes me about it is the repetition of no. Mm-hmm. In a poem that's pretty appreciative, you know, it's affirmative through the use of this, like, this now. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, this is a poem about affirmation, right? No love like you. But as you say, it's like structured through this kind of repetition of the repeated negation. You know, in that one in particular, obviously there's a pattern of repetition, and you know, I'm drawing a lot of language from Melville's chapter, language and details from Melville's chapter, but I'm also trying to compress and kind of lyricize it a little bit by moving it into the format of into the more musical format of the short poem, you know, that's something I try to do in a bunch of these poems in different ways, but this is maybe a particularly clear example where it is the rhythmic repetition that's at the center of the poem.
Before we started recording, you had mentioned that you would put these poems in front of scholars of the environmental humanities, I think, in Europe?
Yeah, so there was I published a couple very early selections from this project in the Glasgow Review of Books, which is a public humanities open source web magazine based in Scotland. And so in some ways they come out of a conversation about the environmental humanities and the blue humanities in you know, sort of through that audience or that vector. And I think of it very much as participating in these questions around blue humanities and environmental humanities and the relationship between humans and the ocean, and the sort of Anthropocene questions about the changes and damage that have been done to the planet in recent decades.
Yeah, so for readers that are less familiar with Melville, what kinds of questions do they ask? What kinds of differences in orientation do they have to the book?
Yeah, I had a wonderful sort of final workshop on this manuscript when I was at the Rachel Carson Center in Germany in the end of 2022. And one of the graduate students who was in the audience was really enthusiastic about the project, but he is not like at all interested in Melville. Like, he's not a literature scholar, he's not an American, he's like, Melville is like not all that interesting, but this project was interesting to him as a way of thinking about the kind of a poetic relationship between humans and the ocean. And I was kind of both flabbergasted, like the idea that you could not be interested in Melville is very weird for me as an American literature professor, but the prospect that they're like, the idea that they're like, the whole structure of this book is designed for multiple points of entry. Mm-hmm. And that for many people, especially people like us who are literature professors or environmental humanities professors, that point of entry may be textual and literary, but it doesn't have to be. You can also come to it as a swimmer. You can also come to it as someone who is concerned about the fate of the ocean and the fate of the climate in Anthropocene age. You can also come to it as someone who's just interested in seeing the ways in which individual humans can sort of contort themselves into relationship with these alien fluid spaces. I found that both like shocking and kind of inspiring to think that there is an audience for this book that really doesn't necessarily know much about Ahab or doesn't come with the sort of the pre-structured relationship with this classic text. I mean, I think many readers obviously do, and many readers will come to this, and you know, the whole professional Melville community, I'm sure, will have lots of things to say. But I'm also interested in thinking about this book as having an audience beyond that is different from the literary and canonical.
Congratulations again on the publication of the book. Now that this is out in the world, what are you working on? Is there another book in the works? Do you have a hobby?
My hobby is mostly swimming, at least once the weather gets better. I do have a couple books that are sort of in process right now. One is a Blue Humanities Handbook, which is a big international collaborative effort that I'm working on with three other co-editors from different parts of the world. And we've, you know, we're assembling a pretty large group of about 40 authors. And that'll be an interesting project to sort of see through over these next several years. And I'm also working on a little book about storms and about my personal experience of sort of being drawn to go outside in unsafe conditions during storms and hurricanes here in coastal Connecticut, and just thinking a little bit about how storms are changing as the climate changes and what that might mean for us as individuals and also as a community. Here, I mean, it's sort of a storms in coastal Connecticut book to a significant extent, but it's also like a storms in the Anthropocene book as well.
Excellent. We'll keep our eyes out for both of those projects. Oh, and you also the Water and Cognition book is.
Oh yes, I do have another academic book that's also coming out at the same time, which is very exciting. It's sort of weird that these projects, both of which are multi-year projects, both land in the spring of 2024. But with Nick Helms, I co-edited a book called Water and Cognition in Early Modern English Literature that is trying to bring together environmental studies and cognitive studies in readings of early modern English literature. And that is out, you know, just out in March from Amsterdam University Press. So I'm very excited about that one as well.
Very cool. Thank you for coming on the podcast, Steve.
Oh, my pleasure. Really, really nice to talk to you, John.